in the Haftorah for this week, it refers to something which is only questionable if really appears in this week's parasha directly. I'll show you exactly what I mean by that. It's from Ovadia, and we'll read a part of it over here. V'haya Beit Yaakov Eish, uveit Yosef Lahava, uveit Esav Lakash, v'dalku bahem v'achalum v'lo yesirid lebeit Esav ki Hashem diber. The JPS translation, I believe, from 1918, writes, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esav for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esav, for the Lord hath spoken. And that continues afterwards to a very recognizable end. But this prophecy spells out the eventual destruction of Esav. But the process of the destruction, let's be careful, it writes, V'haya Beit Yaakov Eish, uveit Yosef Lehava, uveit Esav Lekash. So Esav is made out of kash, which over here is translated stubble. How would you translate kash?
Straw.
So what do you know about straw? It's flammable. So Yaakov is the fire, but Yosef is what ignites the fire. So it means that the process of the destruction of Esav is dependent upon somehow this combination of Yaakov and of Yosef. Now, the truth is, if we really wanted to speak about the combination of Yaakov and Yosef, we should have saved that for next week, right? Mm-hmm. There it speaks about Yaakov and then Yosef. The Gemara, when it speaks about this, doesn't talk about next week's parsha, rather it goes to last week's parsha. And let's look at source number 2, and then we'll understand what the Gemara is referring to. But Tahar v'telid bein, v'tomer asaf elokim et cherpati. So of course this is Rachel, when she finally gives birth. And she says, v'tikra et shmo Yosef, she calls him Yosef Limor. What she means by this, Yosef Hashem li ben acher. May God give me another son. Now, that's Rachel's response to her birth. Which, by the way, right away creates within our minds a question, what exactly is the relationship between Yosef and Binyamin? Because over here, the very birth of Yosef, what Rachel sees is, let there be another son, which is, again, a very strange thing to say, but it seems to be also setting up some kind of a connection that will eventually be between Yosef and Binyamin. Yaakov's response is completely different. Yaakov's response is, "Vayehi kasher yoldar Rachel Yosef, vayom Yaakov el Lavan shlacheni ve'elcha el mekomi ula'artzi." That Yaakov's response is, "It's time to go home." So obviously the question is, what is the relationship between "Vayehi kasher yoldar Rachel Yosef"? What's the relationship in that once Rachel gives birth to Yosef, now Yaakov says it's time to go home? What's the connection between the birth of Yosef and the return of Yaakov to Eretz Yisrael? Why should those things be connected? So it seems to be a little bit more than that. But why this son specifically? Okay. The Gemara in Source 3, the Gemara in Baba Batra says, Bo minei Rabbi Chalmi Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani mi Rabbi Yonatan. K'tiv, it says, V'yihi kasher yodar Rachel v'Yosef v'gomer, and so on. Maishna ki et yelid Yosef. What's so special, what's so different, the fact that Yosef was born? Amar lei. He answers, Ra'a Yaakov Avinu she'en zaro shel Esav nimsar elu biyad zaro shel Yosef. She'ne'amar, v'yabet Yaakov esh uveit Yosef lava uveit Esav lakash. Now the Gemara says is that Yaakov understands that the eventual destruction of Esav will come at the hands of Yosef, or at a descendant of Yosef. Now, this in of by itself is somewhat perplexing. because as far as our knowledge of scripture goes, we don't necessarily find any confrontation directly between between Yosef and Esav. We don't find any interaction, we don't find anything having to do with one another, and we don't find Esav falling to Yosef. So therefore, when we read this Gemara, we have to question, what in the world is this talking about? So let me just say, and even though we have 8 pages of sources, let me say something which isn't here. There is a tradition, which I don't know how well known it is, or how prominent it is. In Judaism, we have many references to the concept of Mashiach. And the reference of Mashiach is obviously a biblical concept, the idea of being Mashuach, of having oil poured upon someone, somebody being anointed. The idea finds itself many times in the Navi, in terms of David HaMelech being anointed and kings generally being anointed. There's also beforehand Kohanim and others. But we find also Mashiach being referred to as the anointed one, and therefore Mashiach is called Mashiach because of the anointment. There is also a concept which, to the best of my knowledge, is only mentioned in the Gemara. I can only think off the top of my head right now one time that it's mentioned, it may be a second time. But the Gemara speaks of 2 different Mashiach. The Gemara speaks about the more prominent one, which, as I said, the Navi scripture speaks of, and that's Mashiach ben David. There is also a reference to Mashiach ben Yosef. The only thing the Gemara tells us about Mashiach ben Yosef is that he's supposed to die along the way. Well, I'm not sure what I mean along the way. This is a Gemara in Sukkah on page 52, Daf Nun Bet. The Gemara there talks about an incredible amount of crying that will take place in the future. Future, at least from the Gemara's perspective. And then there's 2 different opinions what that crying is about. One opinion is that it's about the death of Mashiach ben Yosef. And the other opinion is that it's about, in the end of days, when both the Rasha'im and the Tzadikim have an understanding of what the Yetzer Hara is and how they either succumbed or how they defeated the Yetzer Hara, and that's going to be the crying at the end of days. With, obviously, you appreciate that we can spend a lot of time trying to explain certainly the second part in terms of the nature of the Yetzer Hara, but this only reference that we see is about Mashiach ben Yosef dying. Despite this, the greatest of the Kabbalists from the Middle Ages onwards have insisted that Mashiach ben Yosef does not have to die, and that Mashiach ben Yosef, we only think that he's dead. I don't want to hear anything about... because Mashiach ben Yosef is patterned after Yosef, and for many, many years, Yaakov thought Yosef was dead. But Od Yosef Chai. The person who probably developed the idea of Mashiach ben Yosef more than anyone else, and the person who saw it as an intrinsic and essential part of his eschatology, of his vision of end of days, was the Vilna Gaon. And if any of you want homework, you can go to a bookstore and you can buy a book which is called Kol HaTor. There have been at least 4 different editions of it, and you want to get the most recent edition, which was published by the great-grandson of the person who wrote it. The Kol HaTor is a written version of the oral tradition which the Vilna Gaon instructed his students to come back and to inhabit Eretz Yisrael. And it was written by somebody whose name is Rivlin. There are numerous Rivlins in Israel today. The Rivlin family began, they're the ones who started the yeshuv. They're the ones who, the first building outside of Yerushalayim was, the Rivlins were responsible for. And the first Rivlin who came to Israel was actually a cousin of the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon told him to come, and the Vilna Gaon told him that he himself had tried to come to Israel, didn't work out, and the entire philosophy of the Vilna Gaon is based upon the idea of Mashiach ben Yosef. This book goes into incredible detail of how Mashiach ben Yosef works, what the rules are, and the name Yosef is the numerical value is 156. So he has in the second chapter 156 different elements of Mashiach ben Yosef. So, as I said, if you want your homework, you can go and you can read the book, and then you can understand why we're here today. It's probably the most important document in terms of what you would call religious Zionism. Okay, I say that without a hesitation because I don't know anything else which is nearly as important, because not only does this speak about the philosophy, you'll then realize how things were planned 200 years ago in Vilna in order to get where we are today. Yeah. If you want it for free in English, email me and I'll send you a copy, which is on the web someplace, but I have the file someplace at home, and you can read the whole thing in English. Okay. Kol HaTor, the sound of the dove. Now, if this is a reference to Mashiach ben Yosef, then what we have over here is not a description of something which we should have expected to find in the Torah, namely a confrontation between Esav and Yosef, but rather this Gemara is telling us of what's going to happen in the future. And again, read the words of the Gemara again. El ra'a Yaakov Avinu. What does it mean, ra'a? He sees. Ra'a Yaakov Avinu she'en zaro shel Esav nimsar el biyad zaro shel Yosef. By the way, it's not talking about Yosef. The Gemara is clearly not referring to Yosef. It's talking about that he sees that Zar'o shel Esav, the descendants of Esav, will fall biyad Zar'o shel Yosef, in the hands of the Zar'o shel Yosef. Therefore, this Gemara is clearly talking about something which will take place or would take place, but not something which necessarily took place. Now, this reference is very interesting, because let's go back to this week's parasha just a little bit. Don't worry, we won't stay there too long. What do we read from the very beginning? Yaakov starts to come back to Israel. What happens? He tries to reach out to Esav. He hears that Esav is coming with 400 men. He is completely frightened. Again, that's what it says in the Chumash. He prepares for battle. He prays, and he thinks he's going to get annihilated. That's what the Chumash says. Which means it's so interesting to read the Gemara here saying, why is Yaakov going back? And especially, Yaakov knows it's going to happen. Meaning, knowing Parshat Vayishlach, how do we understand Parshat Vayetze? Knowing, unless you're going to tell me that Yaakov doesn't really think Esav is still upset with him. But apparently he does, because he tries to send messages, he tries to send gifts, he knows what's going to happen, and nonetheless it says, as soon as Yosef is born, he says, okay, let's go. So apparently, there is something about the birth of Yosef that inspires Yaakov to be able to return to Israel. Now the Gemara is telling us it's not just about Yaakov and Yosef, and this is this typical concept that we know of Maaseh Avot Siman Levanim, that things that played itself out in Bereshit actually have a great deal of import for what's going to take place in the future. So over here, that's what the Gemara seems to be telling us. Although I do want to stress, who does the Gemara identify exclusively? Zar'o shel Yosef, which means this is a descendant of Yosef. When I say descendant of Yosef, and not whom? Well, we already noticed in the very beginning, at least as far as Rachel is concerned, that there is some kind of a connection between Yosef and Binyamin. So the question is this exclusively Yosef? And why would I say it's exclusively Yosef? Because that's what the Gemara says, it's exclusively Yosef. Nonetheless, there are other sources that may or may not broaden this a little bit. Let's just take a look, for example. In Midrash Rabbah, in source 24, you have it? V'yihi, this is Medrash Rabbah in Bereshit. Go ahead, on this verse. V'yihi kasha yolda Rachel et Yosef, kaven shenolad Yosef, nolad sitno shel Esav. What does the word sitno mean? It's like the word Satan, the adversary. When Yosef is born, the adversary of Esav, right, is born. Shenamar ve'yom Yaakov elavan shlachenu velcha el mekami ulartzi. Damar Pinchas b'shem Rav Shem ben Nachman misarati she'en Esav nofel el biyad baneha sharachel. What's the matter? You look. Let me translate first, because this is, we have a tradition that Esav will only fall in the hands of a descendant of Rachel. Now, I could, right. When I read this source, I could have said that it means exclusively Yosef, because it says, Kevon shel Yosef nolad sitno shel Esav, but I do have to at least consider the possibility that it opens up the door over here for Benjamin as well, because it says Baneha, which is plural, Baneha shel Rachel, that it says that Esav will fall in the hands of Baneha shel Rachel. So really what we need to understand is what is there about Yosef which serves as the flame to ignite the fire against Esav? Why specifically Yosef? And that will really take us much more directly to understanding this week's Haftorah. On the other hand, to understand, is there a possibility that this speaks about Binyamin as well? And if that's the case, then what is the connection? Because Binyamin is not mentioned in Haftorah. Again, it specifically is Beit Yosef, and not, it doesn't say Baneha Shel Rachel. The Haftorah speaks about Yosef and not about Binyamin. The verse which is quoted at the end over here is a verse from Yirmiyahu, which speaks about Tzi'irei Hatzon, the youngest of the Tzon, v'lamahu korei otam Tzi'irei Hatzon shehim Tzi'irim shebishvatim, which is the end of source 24. Over here it says that what is the power over here of, we can then say, Yosef and Binyamin. Why would I add Binyamin? Because it says Tzi'irei. Again, it's the plural, it's Tzi'irei. It's the Tzi'irim shebishvatim, the youngest of the tribes, which, by the way, is an incredibly important point. This is my one-minute book report. If we had to write a book report on Bereshit, I've said this before, that what is the theme of Sefer Bereshit? The entire theme of the entire book of Bereshit is that the older son fails and the younger is successful. That's what the whole book is about. And that seems to be encapsulated in this line over here, saying not only is this what the book is about, this is ultimately about ultimately this concept will lead to the fall of Esav. Now, I said to you 2 weeks ago that when we see Esav, we have to be careful if this is talking about the biblical Esav, or it's talking about Rome, or it's talking about Christianity. Over here, once we've gone from the past into the future, we can clearly assume that it's not talking about exclusively the biblical person, it's speaking about the descendants of, which could be descendants both genealogically and in terms of ideology. Let's stay on Binyamin for a moment, and then we'll go back, hopefully, to Yosef. When it comes to Binyamin, which descendant of Binyamin do we find had some kind of a conflict with a descendant of Esav? Mordechai is the only one, or before Mordechai? What? Shaul. Right. Now, Shaul, there is something there, but it doesn't work. Now, is Mordechai, in fact, a descendant of Binyamin? It's unclear. Maybe. Maybe is a good answer. Look at source 26. Ish Yehudi. What does Ish Yehudi be? Ish Yehudi could be from Yehuda. We don't know what Yehudi means. In our jargon, Yehudi would mean a Jew, but that's not true necessarily in the jargon here. Well, you could argue. You really could argue. Because at the end of the Megillah, it talks of people who are mityahadim. So therefore, you could claim that it means Jewish. If you look at Rashi, who quotes the Gemara, I don't have it here, on this verse, it asks, well, first let's read the entire verse, then we can see what Rashi asks. Ish Yehudi ayah b'shushan abira, ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shim'i ben Kish Ish Yemini. So it says, make up your mind. Is he Ish Yehudi or is he Ish Yemini? You have a contradiction from the beginning of the verse to the end of the verse. So is he in fact from Yehuda or is he in fact from Binyamin? Yemini would be Binyamin. You could, as I said, you could make that claim. I wouldn't argue with you, but as I said, the Gemara asks, and Rashi quotes the question, make up your mind, which is it? Is it Ishi Hudi or is it Ishi Mani? And it presents various possibilities, including the identity of his mother or his father, and who is he. But it sounds to be that when we look at his father's side, Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimei ben Kish, which, by the way, telescopes the genealogy, because it doesn't give us every line all the way to Kish. Who is Kish? Shaul's... Okay. What? Shaul ben Kish. Which means, what it does is it telescopes his genealogy going right back to Shaul, telling us, therefore, that seems to be the assumption, because it's Ish Yimini. So therefore, you know, sometimes when you read things like this, you think it's giving you a direct son after son after son. And other times, it's not. It's just telling you, this is the family line, giving us the important stops along the way. So over here, by skipping Shaul and going back to Shaul's father, it's really telling us that something that Shaul was supposed to do, which wasn't done, is going to be accomplished over here. So what is it that Shaul's supposed to do? Shaul's supposed to wipe out Amalek. And what does he do? He gives them a chance, which is why they come back to attack us again. Source 27 writes, next chapter, Megillat Esther. I know you're thinking that it's right before Hanukkah, why are we talking about Purim? Leave me alone. V'kol avdei hamelech asher bishar hamelech korim u'mishtachavim lahaman kichein tziva lo hamelech. So all the servants of the king and the shar hamelech, they bow down and prostrate themselves to Haman, for that was the order of the king. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. And Mordechai, now, before I translate, what tense is the yichra and yishtachaveh? Right, it's this infinite... Right, Mordechai does not, but it's not didn't. What it should have said, right? Lo kara, right? In the past, it's Mordechai didn't. So over here, it's saying this in this infinite state. Mordechai does not bow down. Mordechai will never bow down. There is no subservience when it comes to Mordechai vis-a-vis Haman. So till 7:30 this morning, I thought that the source of what I'm about to say was in source 30, which goes back to the Arizal, but in fact I found in source 28, we just took the idea back 300 years and took it from a mystical source to the Baalei Tosfot. He's commenting on Yedid Hashem Yishkon Levetach, Alav Abracha towards Binyamin at the end of Dvarim by Moshe. It says, Ma tam shchina b'chelek Binyamin, which is a wonderful question. Why of all of the Shvatim will the Beit HaMikdash eventually be built in the chelek of Binyamin? Now, by the way, is the Beit HaMikdash in Binyamin or is it in Yehuda? So it seems to be that there is this division between Binyamin and Yehuda, and the Kodesh Kodashim is in one and the Beit HaMikdash is in the other, but when it comes down to it, is the holiest part of the Shekhinah is right there in the part of Binyamin. And therefore, the Beit HaMikdash is the point of the meeting between Yehuda and Binyamin, which, by the way, should be fascinating to you as we get now to the last third of Sefer Bereshit, where the major theme is the connection between Yehuda, or the connection or the confrontation between Yehuda and Yosef, or, say it a little differently, the confrontation between B'nai Leah and its lead representative and B'nai Rachel and its lead representative. And hopefully, and what we would have hoped for is a total reconciliation between B'nai Rachel and B'nai Leah, and that would have perhaps caused Bereshit to end differently and maybe Jewish history to be different. Instead, we never quite find, I'll say, total comfort between B'nai Rachel and B'nai Leah. We find that they somehow work things out, but it's not all that convincing, especially right after Yaakov dies, when they go over and say to Yosef, please don't kill us. So apparently, you know, whatever agreement they had, however they worked things out, was not necessarily heartfelt. On the other hand, we find that Binyamin represents the unifying force among all the brothers. Because the brothers, while their relationship with Yosef is perfidious, when it comes to their relationship with Binyamin, it is one of unity. Binyamin becomes the thing, the catalyst which unites all of the Shvatim. So if he's the catalyst that unites them, so therefore it would make sense that the Shekhinah or the Kodesh Kodeshim or the Beit HaMikdash would be within his portion. Right? Well, that's what we would have said. What does it say over here in the Tosfot? Ma tam Shekhinah b'chelek Binyamin l'fi shehu levado nolad be'eretz Yisrael. So first of all, so he represents Kedusha, and therefore it makes sense that the Beit HaMikdash would be in his portion and no one else. That's the first suggestion that he gives. Second suggestion that Tosfot gives, v'yesh mefreshim she'adayin lo nolad kishehishtachavu hashvatim la'esav. That he wasn't born yet when all the other tribes bowed down to Esav, which means that all the other tribes were tainted by this bowing down to Esav, and therefore there was this fear that they would spiritually be subservient to Esav because they bowed down in the past, but it was only Binyamin who didn't. And what verse does he use to prove this? And he goes, his proof is that, look, Mordechai will not bow down. Again, in the future, Mordechai doesn't have to. Why? Shifto ein mishtachavim l'shum birya. His shevet is not subservient, does not bow down to anyone. Ki nolad mi binyamin shelo hishtachave l'esav. Okay, so this, as I said today, not only did we find it in Tosfot instead of the Arizal a couple hundred years later, Tosfot quotes it, v'yesh mefreshim. So therefore, we still have to do a little bit more work and find out exactly where Tosfot is getting this from, but he's telling us that he found this from an earlier source. The Arizal in source 30 in the Sefer HaLikutim, I'm not sure how much to go into this, because if we do go into this, we'll never get out of it. But there's at least one thing which is interesting. There's at least one thing which is interesting, which he starts with the beginning and talking about the implication of the sin of Adam Arishon, which causes the combination of Eitz Da Tov V'Ra. Let me explain that. Look at the first line. Daki kasher achal adam rishon me'etz adat tov v'ra garam shenit kalel lametet klalot. That when Adam rishon ate from the etz adat tov v'ra. Now, what's the result of eating from the etz adat tov v'ra? Now tov and ra are combined together, and tov and ra need to be discerned and need to be separated. Again, when you eat from an Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra, the result is that now Tov and Ra are combined together. So where do you know of a pregnancy? I'm leading the witness over here. Where do you know of a pregnancy where Tov and Ra are combined together? So that would be the pregnancy of Rivka. That means that within the potential, he doesn't say that, I'm saying that, that within the pregnancy of Rivka, there now will be an ability of discerning between Tov and Ra, which means somehow this birth can cause or lead to a healing of the sin which took place, or the result of the sin which took place in Gan Eden. So keep that in mind. Little further along the line, we skipped a whole bunch over here by the end of the line. V'acher kach kam Yitzchak Avinu mitzad ha-tahara v'kdusha mitzad Avraham v'yolech gam hu mitaken l'klipot. That Yitzchak still has an Esav, but then Yaakov comes and he's the one who tries to fix the entire world. He then goes into all kinds of things that he fixes, including you can read this whole thing also. When you finish Kol HaTor, you can read this. The next part, which is underlined, "Vayomer Areich v'nikarech sadeh shebrachah Hashem kvar yadati ki adam rishon nivra began Eden nikra sadeh shel tapuchin." That's in the Zohar. Gan Eden is called the Field of Apples. Those of you who are all going to tell me, no, apples comes from some Christian artist in the Middle Ages. So you should know that Chaklin Tapuchin, which you find also in various Zmirot, the Field of Apples is referred to as by the Zohar as Gan Eden. By the way, the bigger question is if Tapuach means apple. That's the bigger question. Okay? Va'achaka kesheba malach v'ne'avak imo v'naga b'kaf yerech Yaakov b'netzach. Va'az chazar ha'olam lehitmotet. V'gavra koach ha'klipa ba'oto sha'a. V'ya yared b'kol tzinirei ha'midot. K'shdil ha'netzach az amad shem koach ha'klipa. Mo'yad nasa masach mavdil v'nistamot tzinirei ha'nevu'ah. So I'm going to say this in very simple English. That when Yaakov wrestled with the angel, which does take us back to this week's parasha, his leg was hurt, and that caused all kinds of problems to come back into the world again. But now look what he does right afterwards. Uviyotchi Yaakov Hishtachavela Esav Kaf Bet Pa'amim. There's a Nimraz Megillah, which is a fascinating reference that he makes. Look up at Hishtachavela Esav Yaakov LeEsav. Uvize Kiviyachol Nimnu Mi Beta Otiot HaTorah Lachin Lo Nitken HaNetzach She Yaakov Ad Sheba Echad Mizera Bibimim V'Yitaken. Which means what he just now did is he directly connected the wrestling of Yaakov when his leg gets hurt to the bowing down, which is done afterwards. Which means, think a second. In this week's parsha, there's two things that happen. I mean, there's many things, but there's two things I want to focus on. One is Yaakov has a confrontation with who Rashi and Chazal identify with Saro Shel Esav, the power of Esav in the world. And what happens with him? They get into a fight, they have a confrontation, Yaakov gets hurt. Then Yaakov meets the real Esav, and what happens? Everything works out okay. So that's interesting. That when it comes to the Saroshel Esav, then there's a fight and he's hurt. When it comes to Esav himself, it looks like everything's okay. So what did we just now learn? We just now learned the same thing happened to both. What is it? That the hurting of Yaakov's leg is a reference to bowing down. And therefore, what we're told happens in this dreamlike sequence where Yaakov wrestles with the Saroshel Esav, where his leg gets hurt, that then is actually followed in reality where Yaakov is spiritually damaged when Yaakov bows down to Esav. So therefore, all of the right-wing fanatical nationalists among us can say that therefore we should never bow down to Esav and we should never be subservient, or you can say the opposite is true if you want. You could say the fact that Yaakov did bow down creates therefore the need for Klal Yisrael at times to be subservient. As I said, never let facts like Torah in any way impact your political agenda. But what we now understand is that Yaakov's bowing down is connected to his leg being hurt, and that therefore becomes a sort of a foreshadowing as far as their rizal is concerned. It's a sort of foreshadowing for the bowing down, which now we understand how terrible this really is. And look how much we got stuck with Binyamin. We didn't have a chance to get back to Yosef yet. But what we are told so far is that Binyamin, who is this descendant of Rachel, has the ability of defeating Esav. What we don't know is why Yosef has the ability of defeating Esav, because Yosef is part of the bowing down, and therefore this whole train of thought does not exist in terms of Yosef, only helps in terms of Binyamin, which, by the way, was not mentioned by the Gemara. Of course, when the Gemara said this, it only said, when Yosef is born, Yosef is this counter power to Esav. The Midrash was the one who said the descendants of Rachel. And one more thought. When we think about Rachel, we know that Leah was the one who was supposed to marry Esav, according to the Midrash. So we wonder out loud how much that has to do with this whole thing, where Rachel generally has no subservience to Esav, has nothing to do with Esav. Okay, as I said, just as a thought. As far as this idea of Mashiach ben Yosef, and specifically of Yosef, there's a couple of stops along the way that will help us understand this. First of all, the whole role of Yehoshua. As much as I would say that Yosef is the prototype for Mashiach ben Yosef, Yehoshua becomes the actuality of that potential. And therefore, it's quite significant that when Am Yisrael are going to fight Amalek, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Yehoshua and says, Yehoshua, go down. Yehoshua, obviously, being a descendant of Yosef. So Yehoshua is the one who's actually able to fight against Yosef. That's understood by the Midrash, and then obviously afterwards by all the Mefarshim, as being an indication. If you want to, we'll look quickly, we'll see it referenced to other places, but if you look at Source 6, the Maharal and the Gur Aryeh says, V'im tomar v'lama mana Moshe achar tachtav, why does Moshe appoint somebody else in his place? V'yesh lama k'moshe, Source 6, page 2, k'moshe amru zechrono l'fra, as Chazal said, Vayomo shel Yehoshua, lefisha hu mizaro shel Yosef. V'chtiva ya Beit Yosef esh, Beit Yaakov esh, u'Beit Yosef lahava, u'Beit Esav lakash. Va'amalo mizera Esav, lakach mana et Yehoshua. That when the battle is against Esav, there's no one better to use than a descendant of Yosef, and therefore Yehoshua becomes our first prototype. If you look at the Chizkuni in source number 7, he writes, he's talking about the birth of Yaakov and Esav. Im kein lama noldu te'omim lefi she'ein kash below tivua ve'ein tivua below kash she'ne'amar u'beit Esav lekash u'chtiv kadosh Yisrael Hashem reshit tivuato ve'yakov levado ne'amar v'inei te'omim bevitna. He's bothered, right? The starting point is how Te'omim is spelled, if it's spelled with an aleph, without, with above, without, if it's spelled defective or complete. What he wants to say is that there is one complete child, there's one incomplete child, which is ironic because the name Esav comes from the word asui, or complete. That Esav is complete, but nonetheless it's saying that there is one complete child. Who's the complete child? The one who's incomplete. Because the one who's incomplete is the one who's going to spiritually grow. The child who is as complete as he'll ever get at the point of birth, and that's what you see about Esav, is that he's very complete. He's hairy and whatever, he's very complete. But if he really is asui, if he really has reached his spiritual and emotional development at that point, that's a very frightening thought. So therefore, the child who's complete, we're told, is incomplete, and the child who's incomplete, we're told, is actually the one who's complete. But he said another thing along the way. He goes back to this reference of kash and tivua. He talks about the straw or the stalks which protect the wheat, and therefore, in order to have wheat, you need something on the outside to protect it, which is really quite important, because what it's telling us is that there is really two inside, but one is the ikar and one is the tafel. One needs to be protected, the other is there to protect it. Which, by the way, the only reason that Esav would be considered to be, you know, rejected completely is if Esav doesn't live up to that responsibility of protecting Yaakov. If Esav's able to protect, you hear me? If Esav is able to protect Yaakov, then both of them are fulfilling their role. Esav, who on the outside looks very well, you know, developed, but actually there's nothing inside, because what's inside is really Yaakov, and the role of Esav is to protect Yaakov. If I then separate them, what do I then have? I have straw. What happens to that straw? That straw gets burnt, and that goes back to the theme within the Haftorah. A couple of the Mefarshim will now ask the question that we really should have asked from the very beginning. If you look in source 8, the Toldot Yitzchak asks, V'yesh l'shol, lama Yosef sitno shel Esav yoter mishar echid? What about Yosef enables him to be the adversary to Esav more than the rest of the brothers? Hatshuva sheYosef yavo im Esav ladin, that Yosef would be able to confront Esav. And over here it makes the confrontation not a physical confrontation, but a moral confrontation, to be able to go to court against him, and each one would argue the merits of their position. And he would ask, Lama asita ra la achicha Yaakov? Yosef would then say to Esav, why did you mistreat your brother? And he quotes other parts of the Haftarah, which you can look up afterwards. And he'll have no ability to answer him, which means, think a second. If Yosef asks Esav, why did you treat your brother so poorly? What will the response be? Because he stole the bracha from me. He did terrible things to me. So what's Yosef going to say? And my brothers didn't do terrible things to me? And my brothers didn't treat me worse than your brother treated you? My brother didn't sell me as a slave? Think a second what my brothers did to me and how I paid them back. What did I do? I took care of them and gave them food, which ultimately is really what you should have done. Let's read the answer. Shelo yechol lomar lo ata asita ra lachicha she'ad rabba heim asu lo ra'a v'hu shalem lahem tova tachat ra'a. Which, of course, you can argue with this whole general understanding of what Yosef and how he responds, but it's getting to the bottom line. V'yichalkel Yosef et aviv et achiv lechem l'fi hataf. That Yosef ends up giving them enough food according to the amount of people there. Aval shar b'nei Yaakov sheikansu l'dinin Esav yamru madua asita ra l'achicha yashiv lahem gam ken atem asitam ra al Yosef achichem v'vikashtem hargo u'morchatim etzo mitzrayimah. That when it comes to, again, a moral argument, the other brothers will not be able to defend themselves while Yosef could defend himself, and therefore it sees the superiority of Yosef towards Esav as being a moral superiority in terms of one particular point. Yitzchak focuses on the treatment of the brothers. The Kli Yakar, source 9, ועוד שיוסף סתנו של לפי שעשיו אין לו טענה של יעקב כי אמא שלקח ממנו בחורה. What is the argument that Esav has against Yaakov? He took the בחורה. ולעתיד יוסף משיב לו כשם שנלקחה הבחורה מרובן על ידי שחילול יצועי אביו ונתנה ליוסף. כך בדיד נלקחה מעשיו שיצד נשים תחת בעליהם ונתנה ליעקב. So again, it creates a moral stance. But it's saying the reason Esav would be upset is that the Bechora was taken from Esav and given to Yaakov. What would Yosef say? Well, take a look. The Bechora was taken from Reuven because it says that Reuven got up and went on to Bilhah's bed. So it says, and again, this now is on a midrashic level, that Esav was guilty. He was tzad nashim tachet baleim, that he was somebody who was also guilty of sexual immorality. And therefore, v'kibalta brachot lui b'bechora, k'mvura l'mala b'parashat toldot, and he tells us, therefore, that the brachot are connected to the bechora, and once he lost the bechora, he also lost the brachot. Now, both of these commentaries is interesting to me, because both of them are very interesting, and they focused on one particular point, but they could have quoted for the Medrash Tanchuma in source number 10, which goes through a much more developed argument of Yosef against Esav. Rav Pinchas b'shem Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman Amar. Mesoret Agadahi biyad b'nei shel Rachel, Esav nofel. We have a tradition that in the hands of the descendants of descendants of Rachel, and this is interesting because, again, this is like the midrash that we saw earlier, it is Rachel's descendants and not just Yosef. Within the hands of descendants of Rachel, Esav will fall. Shenemar, and it quotes the same verse that we saw before, Tzi'irei Hatzon. Amar Moshe Yoshua, which we saw the Maharal quote earlier. That's the reason that Moshe says to Yoshua, "Bachar lanu anashim, neshahu mishevet Yosef, shneir bombo et Elokim ani yerei, uveitav kativ v'lo yerei Elokim." So now it just gave us the first point. Yosef says, "I fear God," but when it comes to Esav, it says that he doesn't fear God. Ze katuv bo na'ar, ze katuv bo katan. Ze katuv bo na'ar, shnevuhu na'ar b'nei bilha, ze katuv katan, hine katan netaticha begoyim. Ze gadal bin shnei tzadikim, v'lo lamad bima'aseihim, ze gadal bin shnei rishayim, v'lo lamad bima'aseihim. Let's pause here for a second. When it does the contrast between Yosef and Esav, Esav grew up in the house of Rivka and Yitzchak, and he should have learned from them. Where does Yosef grow up according to this? In the house of Potiphar. So therefore, the people that have that are his role models at the formative years of his life are Potiphar and his wife, and Yosef doesn't learn from their behavior. Zeh kibel b'chorah mima'asav ha-torvim, v'zeh ibed b'chorah mima'asiv ha-ra'im. One gets the b'chorah because of his good deeds, the other loses it. Zeh kilkel et achiv, one gives financial support to his brothers, v'zeh bikesh laharog et achiv, the other one wants to kill his brother. Zeh gadar atzmo mina erva, one protects himself against erva, u'mishvichut damim, and against murder. And the other soils himself with those sins. One accepts that God will, in the future, remember you. And therefore, everything is over. One of them was willing to give up his life because of the honor of his mother, Shenemar, V'achar Nagash Yosef Rachel Vishtachavu, which means Yosef comes in for, again, this expression, in front of Rachel to protect her. V'zeb Bikesh Laharog Etimio, and the other wanted to kill his mother, Shenemar, V'shichit Rachamav. V'kach Yipol Ze Biyad Ze. And that's the reason why Esav will eventually fall in the hands of Yosef. Rabbi Yochanan continues and says, "Amr Rabbi Yochanan, Omdim kol sarei hashvatim lehizdaveg im saro shel Esav." All of the angels or the power of the various shvatim want to engage in a conflict with the saro shel Esav. Ve'enu nofel biyadam, but he can't fall to any of them. Why? Lefi shelakol echad ve'echad misalkan b'tshuva. By each one of them, he's able to push them away with a response. L'Ruvein Omar, ata nechshadata al pilegesh avicha, u'l'Shimon v'Levi, af atem haragtem et shchem, l'shar hashvatim, atem achartem et achichem, u'bikashtem l'hargo. So he goes one after the other. Ruvein in terms of the pilegesh, Shimon and Levi in terms of shchem, the other shvatim in terms of the mechira, l'Yehuda af ata nechshadata al tamar kalatcha, the whole relationship of Yehuda and Tamar, which is interesting because he's going pretty much into the future to find something condemning against Binyamin, which also over here, despite the fact that the earlier paragraph in this Midrash spoke about the children of Rachel, in this Midrash, the children of Rachel is only focusing on Yosef and is not clearly not focusing on Binyamin, unless you want to tell me that the last paragraph was about both, even though the last paragraph was only speaking really about Yosef, even though it quoted the verse about Se'irim, and it sort of gave us the impression that it was both. Kevan shesaro shel Esav ba umizdaveg lo, once he comes, and the saro shel Esav comes in front of Yosef, Miyad nofel lefanav, he falls in front of him, she'en lo tshuva lahashivo, he has nothing that he can say. Ahu dechtiv vaya beit Yaakov esh, u beit Yosef lahava, u beit Esav lakash. Yeah. Clearly. Which is interesting, that it is staying on Yosef and not going in any other direction. Among the various things that we're not going to look at are all kinds of Mefarshim here, earlier and later, who try to understand the significance of the Kash. You have like the Shlah in Source 12 that sees the Kash as Roshei Tevot, Kina and Sin'ah, jealousy and hatred, which by the way the brothers did have towards Yosef. Matter of fact, that Yosef's name, one of the gematrias that you do find in the Midrash, that Yosef's name, I told you before, is 156, which is also the value of kinah. That Yosef's whole personality whole identity is wrapped up with kinah, which as far as the Shlah, maybe we'll look at that. We'll do triage here, we'll stay with the Shlah. We'll skip all the others. The Shlah here says, Source 12, Zeo Beit Esav Lakash, Kash Roshei Tevot Kin'ah V'Sin'ah V'ata Shechatu'u HaShvatim V'zeh K'mo Shenema V'yikna'u Bo Echav V'yisna'u Oto. Gormusha naflu ba'avnotenu harabim bidei Esav. V'heim asara harugei malchut. That when the Jews are guilty of jealousy and hatred, this is a flip side of everything we've seen today. When the Jews are guilty of hatred, we end up acting just like Esav. And if we end up acting just like Esav, that becomes the reason that we become subservient to Esav. Which means for Esav to act full of hatred is one thing. For us to act full of hatred is something else. And he says, and that's the reason, and that's the reason, and this is something that you're all familiar with from the davening on Yom Kippur, correct? Which over here, the Shlo tells us, Shehem Gilgul Asara Hashvatim Kidi'ita B'Sefer Hechalot. Sefer Hechalot is an ancient mystical work, and we're told over here that the 10 tribes were reincarnated, or their souls transmigrated, whatever Gilgul actually means, within those 10 sages. Let's skip to where it's underlined. Yosef Amar Le'achav Atem Alul L'Shalom Al-Avichem V'Atem Hu Diuk. Klomer, Atem Ta'alul L'Shalom, you're going to be okay. El-Avichem Shebishamayim Aval Tamutu Od Hapam. But in the future, you're going to die. It's a very frightful commentary over here. What the Shlo is telling us is that the brothers ended a chapter but created a spiritual problem. Just like we saw in the beginning, that the bowing down of the brothers to Esav creates in the future a subservience. Over here it's telling that ultimately the sin of Mechirat Yosef at some point needed to somehow be worked out and to be elevated. And again, we say this, just understand the significance of this teaching. This is something which is incorporated in our davening. We say it in Yom Kippur, in the middle of Musaf, we go through the Hasarei Gemalchut, and very clearly there it says that this is because of the Mechirat Yosef, which the reason why it's so frightening, it's telling you that a person can go through a life and they can think that they made amends, but it could be that the echo of that kind of sin can come later. Again, just to understand this a little deeper, the Hasarei Gemalchut live at the time of the Churban Bayit Sheni. Churban Bayit Sheni was just, why was the second Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Because of Sinat Chinam, which means that throughout history, when Sinat Chinam does not necessarily rear its head, so then the punishment for that sin is not necessarily forthcoming. Which means Yosef and his brothers make up, and the fact that they make up means that things are forgiven at that point. But the fact is that in the future, Sinat Chinam, hating one another, is going to somehow reemerge, and the fact that it reemerges will necessitate something else to happen over here. Let's continue, because he has a couple of other quite interesting things to say. V'zeh haremez mesayi l'kata mekubalim, and that supports the position of some of the Kabbalists, da'amru uvin hugam kain ba'asar hurge malchut. See, it's interesting. If you say Hasarei Gemalchut is for the Mechirat Yosef, then you just have to ask yourself a question, but how many of the brothers were involved? So let's get Binyamin out of it, so you're down to 11. Okay, of the 11, Reuven doesn't seem to be there. But if Reuven isn't there, then he left with 10, and one of those 10 is Yosef, so why should Yosef be there? So our first inclination would be, remove Binyamin, remove Yosef, and now what are you left? You're left with 10, only if you include Reuven. That's what he's saying over here. But if you remember, Reuven says, I'm going to save him later on, so why is Reuven there? So it says, Hu gam kein basarugi melucha, af shlochata im mechirat Yosef, gar melochid bubo yitzay aviv. That he caused the sin by doing what he did in terms of his moving his father's bed. This is incomprehensible, correct? What is the fact that he got on his father's bed after doing Mechirat Yosef? It could be, but Bila, it's Bila. What does it have to do? Oh, over here, I'll quote something from Rav Soloveitchik. It says, where was Reuven? Because remember, Reuven puts him in, and then he goes. So Rashi gives two interpretations. Remember the two? The first one was, it was his turn to take care of his father. I remember that's the first one, the second one. One was that he went to take care of his father. Why is that a little difficult to say? Logically, it's a difficult position. Why? Because if he goes to take care of his father, he's going to travel from Dothan or from Shechem all the way. I mean, he puts his brother in a pit, don't move, goes back to his father, spends his time there with his father, and comes back. So you have a couple days of traveling, you have time with the father, come back, but he's in the pit the whole time. So to say he wants to save Yosef by putting him in the pit, it's a little difficult just to work out the technical part of that. But on the other hand, where is Reuven? Reuven puts in what happens to him. So Rashi gives, as I said, two interpretations. The other interpretation is that that Reuven starts to pray. He starts to pray and to do tshuva. Why does he do tshuva? For what he did. What does the sin have to do with this? So we can now support the shla by that Rashi. Why was he praying at that point? Because, again, I'm telling you now what Rav Soloveitchik said. He says, Reuven is watching the scene unfold. And it hits him. How in the world, okay, you hate your brother, good. How could he go and kill your brother? Even Esav, what does he say when he wants to kill Yaakov? Wait till his father's dead. So at least wait till your father's dead. Which means, fine, you hate your brother. How can you do this to your, how can you do this to your father? And then it hits him that when he got involved in his father's business and he climbed on the bed of Bilhah, whatever that means, at that point, he showed a total lack of respect to his father, which means that what the brothers did had its antecedent in Reuven's sin, which means that when Reuven sees how the brothers can be behaving without any care of their father's thoughts, now it hits him that he has responsibility for this. So at this point, when the brothers start talking about killing Yosef, that's why at this point he breaks down and he starts to pray. So over here, what did the Shlach say? That Reuven also has responsibility. Why does he have responsibility? But it brings another sin. It has nothing to do with this. No, it does have something to do with it, because Reuven's sin does seem to be connected. Next part where it's underlined. Now there's another opinion is, V'yosef atzma v'yam lo ha'ya b'rugei malchut. According to this approach, we were able to exonerate Yosef and Binyamin. V'yesh kadam akubalim, there are some Kabbalists, ha'omrim Reuven lo ha'ya b'chlal asarugei malchut, they remove Reuven. If you remove Reuven, then who do you have to put back in? Yosef. Now what's the problem putting Yosef in? Well, he didn't do it unless he say that it takes two to tango, as they say. I don't know if it takes ten to tango, that'd probably be quite awkward, but it says that Yosef is a baal machloket. He's part of this whole thing, and you put Yosef in. V'Yosef haya echad mehem mitam kihu garam lahem lachet lachto. He causes them to sin. He's involved in this as well. Shehividi batam ra'al avihem. He starts it all with speaking about them. V'shamati miktzad makubalim, and I heard from some of the Kabbalists. The Shla knows many Kabbalists, and here he gives us one more thing, and he says, Ki Rabbi Akiva haya gilgul shel Yosef. The Rabbi Akiva was the gilgul Yosef, and that's why he's called Ulekach nikra Akiva ben Yosef. Ulefi ma shekatavti lemala shel Yosef hu ha'echad, yavo remez b'mitat Rabbi Akiva she'amar yatzta nishmato be'echad, shehu nishmat Yosef. That Rabbi Akiva becomes the nisham of Yosef. V'nei be'inyan yatzta nishmato be'echad, ki balti bo sod echad. This is, of course, a reference to how Rabbi Akiva dies when he was killed by the Romans. Of course, who are the Romans? Romans come from Esav. Rabbi Akiva is being killed, and he's saying Hashem is echad. She be'emet lo hayarak tish'a megulgalim ki Reuven lo chata v'chein Yosef v'binyamin rak shehem shatfu ha'shchina imayim ka'asu acherim v'kivichol ki ilu hayta shchina ozeret b'ma'aseh hazeh. That even though Yosef wasn't a part of it, he agreed not to tell the father about it. Just and according to this approach, Yaakov never knows about it. And then he continues with this a bit. Rabbi Akiva was a son of a ger. And he's saying, and therefore there is a Gemara that as far as gerim go, there is a special place. No, he's a reincarnation of Yosef, but he comes to Yosef. What's the significance? So I'm gonna say this quickly, and by the way, just look quickly at, I'm sorry, I'm really late. Look quickly at source 13, it ends here, it's Kash as Rosh Tevot for Kriyat Shema. What does Rabbi Akiva die saying? He dies saying Kriyat Shema. So one more point. According to all this, Rabbi Akiva, who is... Okay. We'll do this and we'll stop with this. The Mor-e-Naim. Okay, you don't know who the Mor-e-Naim is, correct? You've heard of the Twersky family? Twersky family is descendant of the Mor-e-Naim. He was the Rav in a place called Chernobyl that you may never have heard of had it not been for a certain accident that took place. A certain accident that took place there. It talks. He starts off talking about. I'm sorry, I just want to see how much to do over here. That Esav will come to Kash. Let's go to the third paragraph. No, you can't. You just see this the second paragraph. Sorry. V'zeu shnei goyim bevitneich. Goyim v'loshen chashivut. Ki shnei mechshavim v'shem chashivut. Af shechad hu ra mitzad atzmo. Af, I think it should be mibifnim. I corrected that. Hu tik l'kdusha hamit labeshet bo. Kim v'war la'el sh'neshamot k'doshot k'dolot. Hoyu klun bo. That Esav, even though we describe him as being ra, there was great kedusha and there were great neshamot within Esav. V'zeh she'amru chazal pasuk ki tzayid b'fiv she'sho'el avicha eich ma'asrin et ha'tevin. How do you take ma'asir from tevin? Or in his mind, the Mor-e-Naim, how do you give tzedaka from tevin? That's what ma'asir is, tzedaka. Eich ma'asrin et ha'tevin. V'et ha'melech ki ma'ashekatuv tzayid b'fiv v'tzalomer tzayid ha'neshamot ha'kedushot miluvashin b'fiv. That there were great neshamot that were stuck in his mouth. By the way, the Arizal says that because his mouth was holy, when Esav is killed, his head goes rolling into the Maror Machpelah, not his Yadayim. Yaday Esav can't be saved. The Peh of Esav, there is Kedusha there, and what's the proof? The head ends up going into the Maror Machpelah. So he's saying, no, that there are neshamot kedoshot within there, somehow trapped within Esav. And what do they speak about? They speak about Tevin. That when Yitzchak is talking to Esav, who does he hear? He hears Rabbi Akiva speaking. Who's Rabbi Akiva? The descendant, the Ger, who will one day come out of Esav, that's who he hears. V'noda ki Rabbi Akiva nasa b'tchilot bat kal b'savua, v'diri meno hana'ava yushachun al tevin. Do you remember the story of Rabbi Akiva? So what are they lying on? They're lying on straw. Tevin. And what happens? And she says, we don't have anything. And then Eliyahu comes as an old man and says, do you have any straw? My wife is giving birth. And it says, V'natan l'Rabbi Akiva tevin, v'zeu midat tova ma'od. What? That's the tzedaka from tevin. That's the maser from tevin. That's what the Mor-e-Naim sees over here. V'kol zet safa, I'm three lines from the bottom, v'hisig Yitzchak Avinu, olu v'sham ki b'shad diburo imo, haya omer lo, v'tzalomer haya medaber imo, oto nitzotz k'dosha she'atid liten tzedaka mitevin, shu remez al neshmat Rabbi Akiva. V'havein, he says, please understand this. Shabbat Shalom.